This episode of New Politics was released on the 16th of July, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, Foreign Affairs still featuring prominently for Anthony Albanese, this time it's in the Pacific. The prosecution of Witness K's lawyer is dropped. The continuing case of corruption in New South Wales. And we look at the forgotten pandemic. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, degenerate.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. Foreign Affairs is still featuring quite strongly for the new Labor government, with the Pacific Islands Forum being held this week. The region is becoming an important diplomatic battleground, with the United States announcing that they will establish new embassies in Kiribati and Tonga. The previous Australian government was rightly criticised for neglecting the Pacific region, but it was also the neglect of the United States government as well under the Trump administration, and China decided to fill the void. It's been widely assumed that China's a newcomer to the Pacific region, but it's been a player in the region for some time, quite often offering infrastructure support such as airports, wharves, and medical support through the building of hospitals and provision of medicines. And much of this is through the Belt and Road Initiative created by the President of China, Xi Jinping. The federal government is trying to have a rapprochement with the Chinese government, and it can't be too overt about this, but this is primarily about protecting two-way trade with China, and it's going to take a lot of diplomatic skill to navigate this path between trade with China and the diplomatic interplay between two rival superpowers in the Pacific region.
Australia should be a dominant force in the South Pacific, if only for the size of our economy. The economy took a bit of a battering over the last 9 years, but it's still a relatively large economy and doing still quite okay. And the other thing too is that foreign affairs, like nature, abhors a vacuum. And if there is a spot where influence or power can be gained and manipulated, someone will jump in. That's just the general way of foreign politics, and it's been like that since at least the Treaty of Westphalia, since 1648, and most likely before too. So for, as you rightly said, the Trump administration to start to ignore the South Pacific, where America has had a long involvement, Solomon Islands had American bases, the Philippines, of course, was almost a colony of America. And we don't need to talk about things like Pine Gap in Australia, Okinawa. This isn't really the time to talk about whether that's right or wrong. It's just the way it is, looking at it from that very realist point of view. But with American influence waning in the area, Australia could have stepped in and ramped up its influence a little bit. It didn't either, probably for similar reasons, probably because the aims and objectives of the Trump administration and the Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison governments were not that interested in dealing with the issues and challenges of the South Pacific. Of course, China does see the chance. And that Belt and Road Initiative, by the way, was used in Australia. We've had quite a lot of infrastructure built here from essentially Chinese grants. So it's something that we can't complain that is unfair. Australia has used it anyway. And of course, China's doing it not to militarily take over necessarily, but to do the same thing America has done for the last 100 years and culturally take over, or maybe military take over while you're not noticing because you're watching American music, listening to American films, watching American TV shows, etc. And I'm not really complaining about that. That's some of the best stuff in the world. It really is. China, I think, isn't doing it quite that way. I think they'd rather be seen to be the people who build hospitals and build much-needed roads. And oh, if we put a military base in, it's just because we've run out of room in mainland China and we need to put it somewhere, you know, that type of thing. Australia dropped the ball. They've picked it up again very quickly, I notice. The Solomon Islands has decided to not take up the Chinese deal after speaking to Anthony Albanese and Penny Wong. It's really interesting watching this type of rail politic play out.
Well, it is possible for China to spend a lot more money than Australia ever could in the Pacific region. And of course, the United States has also got a greater capacity to do this as well. But it's a question of whether it wants to or not. And on this occasion, it has decided that, yes, it does want to spend that money, although you can argue, well, all it's doing is setting up some new embassies in Kiribati and Tonga. How much does that actually cost? But also, it's not as though independent countries are just limited to accepting support or trade from one country alone, but the Pacific Islands are playing the diplomatic process very well on in this instance and trying to leverage greater support from the United States. Over the past 15 years, China has provided around $2 billion of support to the region, and for the region, that's actually a lot of money, but not so much for China. But there are some intricate diplomatic games that are being played out here. China's long-term goal is to build military bases in the South Pacific region, or at least give the impression that that is what it wants to do. But for Australia, there's a lot of juggling of different interests. There's trade, there's economics, strategic interests, there's military interests. And it's hard to know where all of this will end, but the primary purpose with all of this has to be the softening of relationships with China, which were terrible under the Morrison government for a wide range of reasons. But all of this has to be repaired, because having a hostile relationship with China or any other country is not in Australia's national interest.
It's not. And yeah, China does a lot of things that we disapprove of. We, I mean, both Eddie and I, but also Australian values. But there's nothing in it for us to do more than try and talk them out of it. And that's part of diplomacy anyway. America does a lot of things that we disagree with. England does a lot of things that we disagree with. The other major trading partners, Japan. But not all countries will do everything in lockstep. But you can't sort of not deal with places who do things that you don't like. You can certainly express your displeasure and try and leverage that they stop doing this stuff through international pressure, through certain negotiations of trade, etc. But if Australia was to pick a war with China, as Peter Dutton kept arguing we should, I doubt the war would last 20 minutes and it would be absolutely catastrophic for Australia. So while we can disapprove, disagree, and make representations to. And I know that sounds weak too, but diplomacy can be very powerful with good diplomats. While we can do that, we should do that, but we should also try to be good neighbours with China as well. I don't like the Chinese government, but we have to get on with them somehow. And sometimes international relations is just gritting your teeth and getting on with it.
Well, you should see what the Chinese government has got to say about you, David. So it's a two-way process.
They know what they did.
But the Pacific Islands Forum, it also provided an opportunity for the Prime Minister to push the government's climate change agenda. He did sign a document with the Pacific Islands agreeing that there is an international climate change emergency. Now, I can't really push any credentials because nothing has been achieved yet. The government did sign a commitment to a 43% reduction in emissions by 2030. So that's only a commitment. And you can't really do much if the new parliament hasn't actually sat yet. That's happening in a couple of weeks' time. Now, it's very obvious that Anthony Albanese wants the entire world to know that there is a new government in office in Australia and that there is a different agenda on climate change. And also that message that Australia wants to be a renewable energy superpower. But saying this is one thing, actually doing it is another. A 43% reduction in emissions is a number. Getting to that number is another issue. And just to point out that this is Labor's target, and before we get all of those people haranguing us and sending us emails about how it should be far greater than 43%, we're not here to argue whether it should be more or not. We're just outlining that this is Labor's target. And becoming a renewable energy superpower, that just doesn't happen like that. And also, one other thing to consider is that 80% of all supplies that are used to create the infrastructure for renewable energy, that's all the solar paneling, photovoltaic cells, wind turbines and propellers, these are mainly produced in China. So having a hostile relationship with the country that produces most of this material is going to be problematic unless you start developing local industries that can produce all of these products as well.
And there seems to be a lack of will to do that. And I know one of the arguments they say is, oh, the wages are too high here, but that's just overly wealthy people whinging about having to give more of their money away than they want to. And I will be fair, wages can be an issue, but transport to here to build can be an issue. Freight, and then getting people to buy from Australia on the outer rather than China closer to the middle. The other thing too is that trade is a useful thing to have.
The Prime Minister is also hosting a Jobs and Skills Summit in early September. Unemployment is now at 3.5%, and that's the lowest that it's been since 1974. And that's always going to be a dodgy figure. Underemployment is still a big issue, and it seems that unemployment itself, or the number of unemployment, is not the issue, but the quality and sustainability of jobs is. And there's a whole range of issues that go along with this. There's productivity, job security, equal pay for equal work, skill shortages. And there's a heavy emphasis within this summit of maximising opportunities within the renewable energy sector and the jobs that will be created through climate change management. So it's early days, but it's pretty clear that the federal government is trying to weave climate change action, not just as an emissions reduction number that has to be met, but through the economy, through jobs, skills development. And a lot of this seems to be taking up the opportunities that were lost over the past 9 years.
If you look at the last 9 years, if you know anything, and this is regardless of whether you're traditional Labor, Greens, Liberal, National or other voter, you should be very angry, particularly the Morrison years where there was a deliberate attempt to stop any attempt at governing at all at a time where we needed governing. There's a lot of work to do to try and regain the lost ground of those 9 years. And the governments who were in then should be ashamed of themselves, and those on pensions and superannuation should pay it back, which is a harsh thing to say, but they did nothing.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
The case against Bernard Collaery has been dropped by the Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus. Collaery was due to be prosecuted for outlining the immoral and possibly illegal actions of the Australian government in the negotiations with the government of East Timor in the early 2000s with the Timor Gap Oil Agreement. And the actual charge was conspiracy to breach the Intelligence Services Act. Bernard Collaery, he was the lawyer representing Witness K, also on the charge of conspiracy to breach the Intelligence Services Act. And Witness K did plead guilty to his charges. And we have to remember that although all of this relates to events from 2004, successive attorneys general, they've stonewalled the prosecution until Christian Porter became the attorney general several years ago. And the case against Witness K was fast-tracked. And the case ended in June 2021 and Witness K was given a suspended sentence. But the overall case seems to be protecting the actions and reputations of senior Liberal Party ministers. Alexander Downer, as foreign minister, was heavily involved in the negotiations of the Timor Sea Treaty, and he ended up becoming an advisor to Woodside Petroleum, which benefited greatly from the oil exploration in the Timor Gap. So there's probably a whole lot of other unsavoury deals that could be uncovered here. But the case against Bernard Collaery, now that it's been dropped, it might seem like that's the end of it, but there's a whole lot of issues behind the scenes that we might never get to find out about.
Intelligence and the world of espionage is something that is closed off to people who aren't a part of it. And half of it's closed off to the other half of that world anyway. It's a little bit like the Streisand effect. Caleri came out and said this is what happened in East Timor. Now, he did the right thing in that. A country that, again, we should be supporting, we should be allowing to thrive because it's within our best interest for them to do. A country whose first president, Jeannine Gusmao, was one of the great figures of the 20th and 21st century, a Mandela type. Now he's retired and out of, I can say this, knowing that he's not going to be caught up in some kind of corruption scandal. And Australia should have let them have half the oil. Now, instead, the government at the time, and I'm not going to mention names here because a lot of this does have to be tested in court as to who and what and why. The government at the time allegedly not only bugged the East Timorese, but gave that information to private companies so they could use it for their own commercial advantage. I find this appalling. If we must have a secret service, and the official policy of nearly every country in the world is that no such thing exists and it's wrong and they all have one, it should not be working in the interests of private companies. It should be working in the interests of the Australian government and the Constitution of Australia. So for the people responsible, we have not only the immoral and illegal act of bugging a confidential business meeting or confidential government meeting, we also have the act that it was done apparently either on the behest of or as a favour to private companies that aren't even fully Australian owned. So Caleri and all of those whistleblowers are heroes. You're under very strict rules to not, at great risk of big punishment, to not explain what's going on. But they saw that something was wrong and felt, and in this case I think rightly, that the Australian people needed to know how their services were being misused to the detriment of weaker people and to the advantage of stronger people. And that's not Australian values.
Well, that is quite a serious accusation to bug the rooms of a president of another country. And that's exactly what the accusation is back in 2004 when Australia and East Timor were negotiating the share of gas and oil royalties. Now, if you know exactly what the side that you're negotiating with is saying in private, well, it just makes your position of negotiation a whole lot easier. But this overall case has got everything in it: illegal phone tapping, spying, international law cases at The Hague, immoral behaviour by a regional power against the newly independent and incredibly poor country, espionage, corruption, big oil companies. Now, the cabinet papers for all of these negotiations will be revealed in 2024, and I've got a feeling that there's going to be a lot of material that's going to be redacted before it gets released in 2024.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot redacted. I know that there are calls for the responsible minister, and again, I'm not mentioning names because these things should be tested in court. I do not doubt for a second that what Caleri and the whistleblower said was true, but till it's been tested in a properly constituted court of law, I'm loath to drag in names that may well seem to be guilty but actually aren't, and in only the way that the law can work this out. But there should be a lot of consequence because it's not even Australia's long-term interest that various private companies got a commercial boost for short-term share windfall for 1 year is just insanely so silly and short-sighted that I hope that all involved, who aren't the whistleblowers but all the others involved, go to jail.
Well, we hope that something does happen there, but Mark Dreyfus has dropped the prosecution now. And overall, this case was shrouded in legal secrecy and it's all been quite Kafkaesque. But he's decided that no further information is going to be released at this stage. Legally, he does have to be careful about not creating precedents for future cases which do involve serious threats to national security and breaches. Witness K, there's no doubt about it, he did breach national security laws, and that's pretty obvious, but he was acting in the public interest. And we have to make sure that the laws are not cornered when it comes across people who are not acting in the public interest. For example, someone trading off government secrets to the National Rifle Association in the US or something like that. But I think it is clear that Mark Dreyfus is clearing off all of these cases where black letter law has been applied, and that includes the case of the Commonwealth prosecuting Richard Boyle, who revealed highly aggressive and questionable debt collection practices by the Australian Taxation Office. Now, unfortunately, there's a great deal of legal process that does have to be followed, but it does show that governments can stop unfair legal proceedings when they want to and when it's in the public interest to do so. So it's obvious that there's a great deal of legal reform that needs to take place when it comes to protection of whistleblowers, and it's probably an issue that will need to be considered in the development of a National Corruption Commission, and that's been promised by the Prime Minister by the end of this year. So it will be interesting to see what type of legal mechanisms are put in place when corruption of this level takes place. And it's not just the protections for the people that point out the corruption and uncover that, but also being able to investigate members of government and officials who do act illegally when negotiating with the foreign government, which is what seems to have happened during the negotiations with East Timor back in 2004.
Yeah, the world of espionage, the world of intelligence is murky. It's ethically questionable. It's strange and bizarre. It's paranoid. Doing the right thing can get you into a lot of trouble. Doing the wrong thing can get you honours and a pay rise. And I suppose you can say that about Australian corporate life too, but that's a whole other discussion for another time. The reason that the John le Carré books still sell very well is that they give you a brief glimpse. Le Carré had to wind back some of his own experiences, apparently, because they were too extreme for people reading the novels to believe. And to be fair, a lot of spy writers don't get it right, because we've caught up into the glamour of James Bond and Jason Bourne, and they're all great, don't get me wrong. But they were never meant to be more than great entertainment and aren't really reflective of the daily life of an agent for the security services of various countries. What Colleri did was pull aside the Band-Aid and got us to see the scars underneath to a small extent. And I'm not sure that Labor will do much, because they will still want an effective intelligence organisation. ASIO and ASIS fall under Home Affairs now. They used to fall under Attorney General, which meant that the Attorney General could make a call as to how illegal what they were proposing to do was. I'm not saying that a competent Home Affairs Minister couldn't do that, but I suspect that they'll move back under Attorney General before too long. And it's within Labor's interest, or the government's interest, to not change things too much, because the information that these agencies get can be very useful, not only in terms of robbing from smaller countries, but looking at terrorist movements and health policies and stuff that other governments may not want promoted, but is in Australia's interest to know. And of course, this is vice versa too. It's a murky and convoluted and confusing state of affairs.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
And speaking of intelligence and corruption, there's been more claims and counterclaims being made in the New South Wales Parliament about the US Trade Commissioner's position. And that's a position that was offered to senior bureaucrat Jenny West before that offer was rescinded and then miraculously provided to John Barilaro after he resigned from the New South Wales Parliament. The issue has now been referred to the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption, and they'll decide whether there's enough corruption in there to investigate. And on the surface, it seems like there's enough corruption to bring down an entire government. It involves the Premier, Dominic Perrottet. It involves the Trade and Investment Minister, Stuart Ayres. It involves a former New South Wales Premier who was also under investigation by the New South Wales ICAC. A number of ministers have made public statements and denials, which have been contradicted by a current New South Wales parliamentary inquiry. And this is what tends to happen to long-term governments, especially one that's been in office for 12 years. But this is so brazen and so overt that it's almost hard to believe.
If you were writing this for a script as Hollow Men, they'd rip it up as too ridiculous. I like how that the successful candidate, they decided she wasn't going to be that good for the position after they took it off her, and she was upset about it. I would have thought that you would be very upset about it, and that being upset about losing a plum job that you'd presumably worked very hard for, and to lose to someone who you'd been told it's a gift for somebody else, I would guess that that would be a fairly normal reaction. Barilaro himself, apparently all the usual caveats and allegedlys, bought a few more qualifications to help pump up his resume, in that he claimed industry experience and was able to RPL, or recognition of prior learning, to get a couple of certificate fours and a couple of diplomas. How he thought he could get the job defeats me. How any of them, and I'm not just talking about the less worldly wise, shall we say, like Perrottet, but some of the smarter Liberal cabinet, there doesn't seem to be anyone yet, and if I'm wrong, please let us know, who has said, oh, this is a bit on the nose and we maybe shouldn't do this. We maybe should find him something else to do. How none of them said that. It is going to be one of the factors that brings Dominic Perrottet down as Premier. There's a couple of other things going on in New South Wales that the rest of Australia isn't that interested in, and I won't bore you with them.
Well, I think we also have to remember that all of this is happening in the context of a Commission Against Corruption, which does exist in New South Wales, which is one of the most powerful in the world, although it is relatively poorly funded. But on paper and legislatively, it's quite a powerful body. Now, it's not a case where if corruption happens, the ICAC is automatically onto it. Issues and incidents do have to be referred to the ICAC, and then it decides whether there's enough information to proceed with a decent inquiry. But you do have to wonder, how much of a deterrent is the presence of an anti-corruption commission? It just seems like there's more corruption than ever in New South Wales, and the bad behaviour just keeps going on and on and on.
There's a sense in which they don't understand what corruption is. And we can trace this back to at least Nick Reiner, who couldn't understand why ICAC would go after him after he improperly appointed Terry Metherell, who was an ex-minister of his and who'd become an independent and was sitting on the crossbench and was essentially coerced to stand down from his seat so that Greiner could get that extra seat in the votes on the House. And proper procedure wasn't properly followed. This was back in 1991. Gladys Berejiklian argued that she couldn't be corrupt because she'd never do anything corrupt, so whatever she did couldn't be corrupt. And again, I believe that she believes that she's an honest person, that she couldn't see that anything wrong had happened, that this is the way that it's always been done. But it's still dishonest and it's still corrupt.
Well, this is Alice in Wonderland sort of material, but we also have to ask the question, well, why did this actually happen? Barilaro was leaving politics, so why do him a favour when it's clearly a situation that's going to come back and bite the government so badly? Normally, when these kinds of political leaders leave office, they say that they're leaving politics to spend more time with family and their kids. And then a few weeks later, they end up taking up a high-powered job in the corporate sector that they probably nurtured while they were actually in office. And all of this stinks, of course. Bob Carr getting a highly paid job with Macquarie Bank, Mike Baird getting another highly paid job with National Australia Bank, Gladys Berejiklian off to Optus in another lucrative job as well. But at least with all of these positions and in all of those cases, they went into the corporate sector. And each of those were the ones who received all the opprobrium at the time, and there was no blowback to the government of the day. But in the case of John Barilaro, he creates the position while he's in government. He leaves government. The new investment and trade minister rescinds the job offer made to another person and then essentially gives it to John Barilaro. How is this not corrupt behaviour? And I don't think there is a court for political ineptitude in New South Wales, but if there was, both John Barilaro And the minister here, Stuart Ayres, they'd be serving life sentences for political ineptitude and stupidity. How on earth they thought that this wouldn't create problems for the New South Wales government is beyond me, and especially in the context of a state election in New South Wales in March 2023, that's 8 months away. And if the ICAC doesn't finish off the New South Wales government, I'd say that the electorate will do the job instead at the next election.
You'd hope so. A lot of people aren't fully aware what's going on. And this is why I think Dominic Perrottet, and I've said that since he got in, that he's not going to make the election. And I don't think he is. I think that they'll move the deck chairs on the Titanic, as it were, and put in a moderate this time, possibly Matt Keane, and lurch over the line again. It's going through a very familiar pattern that's worked for the Liberal Party the last three elections in New South Wales.
I'll be there in the end, and the start of your journey. Feel me in your palms, know me in the water.
COVID cases are rising, and it's almost like there's a forgotten pandemic out there. Medical advice that was being strictly followed during 2020 and 2021 seems to have all been ignored during 2022. 95% of all COVID cases have occurred in 2022. 80% of all deaths have occurred in 2022 as well. Cases are spiking with new variants of the Omicron version of coronavirus appearing. We criticised the federal and New South Wales Liberal governments for letting COVID spiral out of control towards the end of 2021, but the new Labor government seems to be equally unconcerned. The pandemic leave disaster payment that ended on June the 30th, and the free rapid antigen test for concession card holders will end on July the 31st. Now, these were decisions made by the previous government, but Anthony Albanese has said that neither of these programs will be reintroduced. Now, you can't really complain about not enough support being offered by the government when you're in opposition and then refuse to provide support once you're in government. Now, David, you've always suggested that political leaders and governments eventually do disappoint, even when they start off well. But these are the types of programs that Labor governments should be supporting, and at the moment, they're not.
It is defeating me. We're getting to the same types of numbers where they were locking down. Western Australia locked down on one case last year. Now, I do acknowledge that there's a lot of people that have to be a part of the decision. Health should be the primary one, of course. Ronnie Salt, the journalist and commentator, suggested that police are a part of this because they have to put extra personnel enforcing mandates and enforcing lockdowns. And I'll be fair, a lot of police had a pretty brutal time just doing their job and people being more awful to them than normal. So police departments have to be prepared to manage this. Now, I'd argue that there's ways around this. Somebody suggested that it could be like random breath testing, that it's probably not going to happen, but the risk of you getting caught and fined is enough of a deterrent. We don't drink and drive generally. It's the vast majority of drink driving is just over the limit as people calculate, am I ready yet, and calculate wrong. So there are ways around it, I think. And the governments that acted with distinction, McGowan, Dan Andrews, who I'm seeing a massive backlash against, not from the right. He was never like from the right. But the centre and the left are now starting to say this is disappointing. I do understand, actually, that Victoria doesn't want to go into lockdown again, even though New South Wales had more days of lockdown, or nearly as many days as lockdown. New South Wales doesn't want to go into lockdown again. And we get that. But we found that short, sharp lockdowns did work rather than long, extended ones, which did nothing but trash the economy, threw people into uncertainty, and didn't stop the flow that much as people started to sneak around and try and not get caught. Mandating masks is probably a good thing. They've kept those, the hand sanitizers. COVID's airborne, but you know, keeping your hands clean is a good thing anyway. There's also some fairly nasty flus going around at the moment. And of course, had Brad Hazard and Gladys Berejiklian and Dominic Perrottet acted properly back in 2020, we probably wouldn't be in this situation still. We mightn't have defeated it, but we might be in a closer zone to New Zealand where the numbers are much lower.
Well, the Health Minister, Mark Butler, and Treasurer Jim Chalmers, they keep pointing out that there's a large national government debt of almost $1 trillion and that does need to be paid down. Well, yes and no, actually. It does have to be paid down and managed, but it doesn't have to be paid back tomorrow. And the national government finances are actually quite different to managing a household budget, as we've explained on New Politics quite a few times in the past. The message Labor had while they were in opposition was the quality of spending of the former coalition government. Now, for sure, they actually did waste a lot of money through a lack of targeting of budget items, such as JobKeeper, and something like $21 billion out of the $60 billion cost of JobKeeper went to people and businesses who didn't actually need it. But you would think that a pandemic leave disaster payment, and that's where workers who can't access sick leave if they've got COVID, either because they've run out of sick leave or they're casual workers without any sick leave provisions, and also free rapid tests for vulnerable people on social security payments, that would be a good quality spending of government money, as well as delivering a good health outcome. And if they're worried about losing political skin over this, they should lose political skin over the stage three tax cuts and repeal that instead. And if the argument is that you can't afford pandemic leave disaster payments because of a $1 trillion national government debt, well, you can use the same argument against the stage three tax cuts as well, or at least put a temporary levy on high income earners and get the support of the Australian Greens in the Senate, because they'd be very happy to back Labor with this kind of measure.
It's a strange hill for the Labor Party to die on, tax cuts for the wealthy. And again, they don't have to be taken away. They can be delayed. And they'll be whinging and moaning. Jerry Harvey will tell us how badly he's doing, and that, but he's been cancelled anyway, so how are we hearing him? And I'm pretty sure that a lot of the wealthy people who would have got the tax cuts were expecting to lose them when Labor got in anyway, which is why they voted against them. We don't need to go into the merits or not of that. It's a weird place to burn your political capital on, whereas I'd have thought a robust health policy that in the long term the benefits can be seen would have been the better thing. I don't understand what's going on, and a lot of people have already started regretting their vote, although I don't know what the alternative was. And I'd like to think that the strategists are a lot smarter than we think, but we haven't seen a lot of evidence of that either.
And of course, health measures such as mask mandates, which you referred to before, David, and issues relating to social distancing and public hygiene, these are all state and territory issues. And the medical advice coming from the chief health officers and many medical experts in the field is that mask mandates should return, even as a temporary measure. And the public seems to have forgotten about all of these things that they learnt from 2.5 years of this pandemic. And I realise that things are different now to the first part of the pandemic, with 95% of the population with at least two doses of the vaccine has been lagging behind for the third vaccine, and that's around 65% of the population, and the rollout of the fourth vaccine has only just commenced. And it seems like it's a case where the public has lost interest because governments have lost interest as well. And the Prime Minister has called for an emergency national cabinet meeting for early next week, so there could be some movement on this because there are some more contagious variants of coronavirus just around the corner. It's best for governments to remember that we're still in the middle of a pandemic and it's far from over.
Yeah, winter's going to be bad, although we're sort of in the middle of winter now. It's going to get worse before it gets better. We still have our healthcare workers strained, stressed, and leaving in droves. And I know everyone's sick of it, but this is the time where you say, right, we've got to push through this last little bit, and hopefully it can be gone by the end of the year.
And just some late news after we recorded the program. The Labor Party must have listened to us before we put this episode out, because they've just backed down on the pandemic leave disaster payments, and that will be reinstated as soon as possible. So that's a very sensible decision, and it's good to see that governments are listening. That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.